This is Car Expert.
If there is a particular use case that you need to hit, chances are this is going to hit it and probably do a better job than the average SUV.
Unless we get a catastrophic COVID outbreak, I think it's likely that the market will recover this year.
Where stuff like this is still exclusive and you're not going to see them almost ever. So to have something like that, I think it's just really cool.
Happy New Year. Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I'm joined by Anthony Crawford.
Hi, Mandy. How are you? It's good to be back, I suppose.
Definitely. And good to be back with James Wong as well.
Happy New Year, guys. How are you?
Good to start a new year fresh, I think.
We're not sure if this year is going to be better than last year, are we?
Crawford, we positively, hope, right? Yes, it will.
Yes, we must. It must be a better year than last year.
Can it be any worse?
I saw on your socials over the break, Crawf, that you had some time with the Land Rover Defender in that beautiful green and white two-tone. How did you find it?
Yeah, I love that colour. Interestingly, Ben Sykes didn't like the colour. I thought that was so odd.
Our sales manager,
He didn't like it, but he's a strange cat. let's not read too much into that. I think that's the heritage color, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And those heritage cars they came out with a few years ago, they're worth quite a lot of money now, the old Defender. And I think that color, and by the way, that color wasn't its natural color. That was a matte wrap that the factory does, and the actual color is a shiny green, metallic green. But I really like that matte finish on that car. And, of course, it protects from scratches and that makes – I think it makes total sense to have with that. But, look, I've seen a silver with a black pack. I've seen a black – all black, which I thought looked great too. But the silver with black look, I don't think there's a bad color on the new Defender palette.
Did you get a chance to take it off-road?
No, I haven't, but I've at the launch we did an hour of pretty intensive off-roading up in near Lithgow in New South Wales and Western New South Wales, and it's so easy that honestly, you truly the term the grandmother could do it is probably the truest thing of all, because it's just a couple of buttons to engage any of the different off-road modes electronically from the console, and it really is one button. And then a button on the touchscreen, and you're off and running in mud and ruts, or change to sand, or change to water.
Yeah,
it's that easy. But where I think is an amazing the ride. No one can believe the ride comfort both on road and off road. It's staggeringly good, and I suspect with anyone with ambitions of buying a Range Rover for its comfort, you will get the same comfort in a Defender. Hmm. I know it's a hugely broad, sweeping statement, but that's the fact. This car rides as good as a Range Rover, certainly as good or better than a Discovery, current Discovery.
Did you find it was getting a lot of attention while you were driving it over the break?
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
Massive. Honestly, it gets more attention than sports cars.
That's cool.
Certainly than a 911. This car was getting all the... In fact, I had two guys down at the beach at Manly after I'd had a surf, came up to me with their boards and said, "Mate, is this the new Defender? I've just ordered one." He said, "Can I have a look?" And I said, "Mate, hop in." So I reckon I sold two or three at the beach, and that happened almost every day. It's one of those vehicles that people have just got to have.
Yeah.
They'll do anything to get it. I mean, they'll sell everything they've got. They'll sell all their cars to get a new Defender. It's that. It inspires that sort of must-have approach.
You know? Even the old one had quite a big allure. I know a lot of friends of mine that, you know, I'm in my, I like to say mid-20s, but I'm on the wrong side of mid. But I have a lot of friends that really like the old Defender. And so it was like a dream car for them because, you know, a Wrangler's too pedestrian these days. You know, not everyone can afford a G-Wagon, but a Defender was something that they liked the style of and was within reach. And I know that there's been a lot of positive feedback to the look and of the new one. And I've seen quite a few in Melbourne, actually, and I think they look fantastic. So I'm looking forward to getting a steer of one myself.
Yeah, I hope you do, and I'd love to talk to everyone about after they've driven the car, also sort of, you know, the base model starts at, I think it's 70 grand plus on road. So, you know, they're not overly expensive vehicles, but I tell you what, I think the base vehicle, I think you've got to go for the S, which is one up from the base, and then you get leather upholstery and air suspension. I think all of them come with air suspension, which gives it that amazing flexibility and ride comfort.
Yeah. Joey, what car did you have over Christmas?
I was in the Ford Escape Vignale. So the top of the range of the new Ford Escape lineup, Vignale, I think some people might go like Vignale, how do you spell it? It sort of looks like Vignale, or, you know, a lot of people have asked me how to pronounce it. It's a badge that Ford has used overseas, particularly in Europe, for their top of the range models. So it's now the new sort of like luxury sub-brand, if you call it that. So I drove that up to Yarrawonga Mulwala, and it was a very eventful week instead of having a relaxing holiday away, because obviously there was the border closure and I was on the Mulwala side, so I had to rush home and get tested and all that nonsense. So that was fun, but I've been very impressed by the Escape. It's been a good comparison having the top of the range one, because I reviewed the base model shortly after the launch, and to see sort of where the money goes, the extra spend goes in terms of the look and feel of the car and obviously all the extra features. It was a really, really comfortable, cruisy car to drive, you know, 3 hours at a time. So on the way back, we were so stressed because we were trying to get home as quickly as possible, but being able to be in a car that can handle a road trip so nicely has made it that little bit easier. So I've been very impressed by it, and I'm keen to write the review.
What's the major competitors of that, Jawa?
Everything in the mid-size SUV class. I would say its closest rival conceptually would be the Mazda CX-5.
Wow.
Yeah, so Mazda CX-5, Toyota RAV4, all of that class of mid-size SUV. I would say RAV4 and CX-5 are probably the key players there, mainly because they're the sales leaders and, you know, somewhat considered the benchmarks. I guess you can throw in the Volkswagen Tiguan there as well, because the CX-5 and the Tiguan both have high-output turbocharged engines as options at the higher end of the range. And the Escape comes as standard with that 2-litre turbo that has like 184 kilowatts, which is class leading in terms of outputs. And it's the way that that car can just effortlessly get up to speed is just, it feels like you're driving a V6 or something. It's a very powerful but very smooth car. So it's certainly worthy of consideration against the benchmarks in that segment, because, you know, everyone has a RAV4 or CX-5 these days. So to have another player in there that's fundamentally as good, I think is good for punters, because it means they've got more choice.
Any interesting features that Ford have got that others don't?
I wouldn't say that there's anything in particular that the Escape has that others don't, but the overall look and feel is a bit different. So it looks like an enlarged Focus. The design's very focus oriented, so it's got a unique look, but the proportions are really nice. With the Vignale, you get like a wood look trim as the inserts, but it's funny because it's just a plastic, but it's almost been printed with like a wood pattern, but it's really convincing because you look at it and it looks like real wood, but then you touch it and it's smooth, even though it's got the grain on it and everything. And it's got a leather stitch dashboard and all digital instrument display. It's got a head-up display. It's fully featured, and the driver assist tech in Fords is actually really good. All of the European products, I think, is one of the – they have the best – some of the better assist systems when it comes to, like, lane centering and adaptive cruise control.
Yeah. Can I just say there's a hint of DBX in this, like,
yes,
from some angles?
Yeah. So when I was working at the agency with Ford, I remember when they properly revealed everything and we started seeing what the Australian specs would look like. And if you get it in an ST line trim with the blacked out grille and the body kit,
yeah,
it looks suspiciously like a DBX, especially the red press cars that we've seen. You get them side by side and it looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
All right, those reviews will be up at carexpert.com.au very, very shortly. Time for this week's car news. And we start off with a report with you, Jaywo. The next generation Mazda 2 is due this year.
Apparently so. So a report by Best Car Web from overseas claims that a new generation Mazda 2 will be revealed this year on a new platform and will offer a 1.5-litre three-cylinder mild hybrid powertrain. That will be one of several engines that the company will offer globally, according to this report. And the Mazda 2 is probably well overdue for an update now that it's been out for, you know, the better part of half a decade, and most of its rivals have had pretty comprehensive overhauls over the last couple of years. Overseas, previously, they've also offered a turbo diesel, but apparently that's meant to be dropped. And it's also going to pick up a version of the Sky Active X engine, which, for those who don't know, is a type of engine technology that Mazda has recently started rolling out in some of its other models, namely the Mazda 3 and CX-30, where it uses compression ignition combustion technology so that the engine has the free revving nature and high power of a petrol engine, but also the fuel efficiency and low down torque of a diesel. I personally have driven a CX-30 with that engine. I didn't think that it hit the bill quite as well, and it's also very expensive, but as time goes on, I'm sure that they're developing and refining the technology so that one day it will do what it says on the tin. In terms of the styling, it's not expected to change too much from the current car. The current model has been refreshed and facelifted a couple of times now, and it looks quite smart. I guess maybe one of the major changes will probably be for the interior. So I would say that it would be a little bit more upmarket in terms of the interior presentation, because now it's getting a little bit dated, and you'll see like a new infotainment system and driver assistance technologies. And they have also said that the curb weight will be reduced by around 100 kilograms. So an already light car losing that much weight means that it will no doubt be
that's
a bit more fun.
Huge. Is that right?
Well, it's what they claim. I don't have an ear in Mazda's development meetings, but I'm sure.
How did people get it that low?
That is extraordinary amount of weight to shed in an already small car.
Absolutely, yeah. So it'll be very interesting to see, but as we know, you know, you see stuff like the Toyota Yaris and the Volkswagen Polo and, you know, a handful of other light cars that have gotten very, very tech heavy these days, because that kind of car is still very popular in Europe and in other cities like, you know, in Japan, where the cars need to be very compact and very efficient. And so a car like a Mazda 2 may not be very important for a company like Mazda in Australia, but back home and in Europe, it's still very, very important. So for the next generation, we may see the prices jack up again, as we've seen with a lot of cars in this segment of the last couple of years, purely because to add all that technology and all that engineering spending behind it, you know, have to charge more for the car, and it is what it is, unfortunately. But yeah, so we'll have to see what happens. The current car is still selling pretty well. It's up there with the top sellers in the class. It was the fourth best-selling light car in Australia in November, and I think it carried that through to December and the end of the year. But the prices have been up by 30% last year after the refresh. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there, and I'm assuming that will also hint at maybe what's to come from the next CX-3, because they share a platform and essentially have the same interior. So interesting development out of that report. So we'll see how we go.
I was actually I bought a Mazda 2, the current gen. I bought the Genki, and I bought that car because it was the only light car that offered really cool features like a head-up display. Mm-hmm. It was just really, really a great car. So, but I'm surprised they haven't actually refreshed that. Have they refreshed it since 14?
Yeah, they've given it a mild redesign and updated it with new tech. I'm assuming, Croft, is this the Mazda 2 Genki that your daughter drove that you tried to sell to me?
I did. That's the one. Yeah. Why didn't you buy that off me?
Well, at the time, I wasn't really looking for a car, and you know, as you know, I have specific tastes. So when I did buy a car, I wanted something a bit bigger and a bit faster, which is why I have the Golf now.
Yeah, but, fair enough.
You made a very compelling offer, Croft. You know, you're telling me that it's a $30,000 car. It's got a head-up display, and you were going to give it to
LED lights.
Yeah. LED lights. I remember there was very aggressive hand movements associated with those claims as well. Yeah. So I vividly remember that conversation. But I'm glad you enjoyed your time with it.
I did, and she got into a Golf, but she was actually missing the Mazda 2, strangely.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Wow. Good. Well, speaking of hand gestures, Croft, we know you like using your hands and also pronouncing Italian names.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not going to say this Ferrari model. I'm going to let you say it, because it's this model is now being joined by two electric SUVs.
It's the Puro Sangue. It's the Puro Sangue. Beautiful. That's the Italian pronunciation that I would use. And I only lived in Italy for a year and a half, so I'm not completely Italian like Trent Nicolic would call himself. But, yes.
Do you know – what does it translate to, Croft? Do you know?
It's a thoroughbred.
Or pure blood, literally translated, yes.
Yeah. That car, it's interesting because – I was actually with Marchionne long before he passed away, obviously, but at a car show, I think it was Geneva, and I had a personal one-on-one with him because I'd become friends with Ferrari's designer, Flavio, and he introduced me personally to Marchionne. He said he would never, ever do a Ferrari SUV, but I just think the success that Lamborghini have had with Urus globally, and I believe DBX is selling pretty well. Certainly the reports back from that car, I've not driven it, but we've got a review on the site by our correspondent over there, and it says it's a great car to drive, and I suspect Ferrari will turn the wick up even more with this thing, and it will be probably the greatest handling SUV on the planet, I'm assuming.
A super SUV as opposed to a supercar.
Yeah, well, it is pretty much a super. I mean, it's launching with, you know, a V12, 596 kilowatts. I don't know why you'd ever need that in an SUV, but
it gets to school pretty quickly.
It's gonna go so hard, and of course, it's based. I've seen a few pictures of it online, and it seems to mirror the front end of a Roma, which it's sharing its underpinnings with. So. Yeah, it looks brilliant. I would have to say, based on what I've seen, and I assume they're renderings. I don't know if you guys have seen any other shots of it, but it looks pretty impressive for an SUV. And what you'd expect Ferrari to come up with as an SUV, I think it will be gorgeous in the metal. I quite like the Urus, but it's a really huge car. The Urus, the DBX is a lot smaller. Again, that's also an exercise in style, as this is. And I see they're going to bring in a hybrid V8. And that engine will probably be very similar to what comes out of the SF90 Stradale, I suspect. And that will also be incredibly quick and probably even better handling because it's less weight up front, front engine, of course, or front mid, they like to call it. I don't know how much it's going to be. I think the UK are touting £200,000, which would put it at probably over 400,000 Aussie. Yeah. But that's okay. Look, it will be right up there in the scheme of luxury, high performance SUVs. You've got the Bentley Bentayga, which is 430, I think. The DBX is 357. And of course, Maserati have a fairly impressive high-powered SUV in their Levante Trofeo, which sells here for $336,000. So there's quite a few of these things around, but I suspect Ferrari will be in demand. You'll have to wait years to get one, which is their normal MO. Ferrari, you just have to get in a line, and their demand outweighs generally the build number. But, yeah, it's going to be – look, I think all these things, you know, they make the auto industry exciting. You've got to have the Mazda 2s of the world and everything else, but these are the cars where they get the technology that seems to trickle down into, you know, lesser cars over time. And that's why, you know, we got to celebrate cars like this because we do, you know, the common car is the benefactor of this technology over time, you know.
How very true. Now, Joe, FCA PSA merger has finally been approved. We did touch on this quite a long time ago. It's called Stellantis.
Yeah, it's such a cool sounding name, isn't it? It makes me think of so if Atlantis is the city under the sea, this must be the city in the sky. But yeah, so the Stellantis, which is the merger between the Fiat Chrysler Automobile Group and Peugeot Citroën, has been approved by shareholders, meaning that the two can come together and become Stellantis. So apparently the merger will be completed on January 16th, so it's about a week away from being completed, and shares for Stellantis will start trading on January 18th in Paris and Milan, with New York to follow a day later. So this is a pretty big deal. So 14 brands will comprise of this merger, with annual production of around 8 million vehicles. So this includes brands such as Fiat, Chrysler, Ram, Dodge, and Jeep, as well as Peugeot, Citroen, Vauxhall, Opel, DS, Alfa Romeo, and Fiat. And so what they're going to do is try to sort of regionalize these. So we're starting to see this more and more with these big automotive groups, where certain brands and models will be focused on certain markets. On current volume, Stellantis is expected to be the world's fourth largest car maker, behind Toyota and Volkswagen Group, as well as the Renault Nissan Mitsubishi alliance. It will be headed by the current PSA CEO, Carlos Tavares, when it's all completed. So it's a pretty big deal, and I guess this could mean a lot of really great things for both brands. We saw FCA reveal the all-new Grand Cherokee L just yesterday, at the time of recording, which looks like a really big development for that car. And I imagine that with all the different part sharing and research and development centers that all of these different companies will have throughout the world, it can only mean good things for all the different products. I think that, in my opinion personally, a company like Fiat would really benefit from something like this, because it can draw upon the teams from, say, Vauxhall and Opel, which also have very big compact car ranges in Europe, and really refresh that whole line of cars, because a lot of Fiat's vehicles are quite old these days, and they've got the new 500, which is all electric now, but they don't really have anything else coming, so it'll be good to do that kind of stuff. And I imagine that we'll see a lot of platform sharing and part sharing between all these different companies. So while it means that a lot of cars are quite similar, it also ensures a level of consistency, which is something that Volkswagen has done very well across all their different brands, that while a lot of them have shared mechanicals, there's still a different flavor and vibe in all the different brands and their products, but there's a consistency in the competence and quality of their products. So it'll be really interesting to see.
I've heard that rumors that this alliance could spell the end of Chrysler, actually, because Chrysler only have the 300 basically, and Dodge takes care of, you know, pretty much every other segment. Yeah,
or it could even mean the opposite to Chrysler as well, because there's more opportunity, as Gemma was saying, for
I just heard a couple of podcasts in the States that were kind of spouting negative rumors on that brand, that they just didn't have a lineup of cars that. But yeah, you might be right. Who knows? That might be a reinvigoration of it. Yeah. I thought DS was gone, by the way. Like,
DS is gone from here, but it's still quite big in Europe and also in China. Yeah. In China, yeah. So it's still a fairly decent deal over in those markets.
Yeah.
So I think, particularly in China, actually, because that market likes the allure of a luxury badge, no matter where it's from. So there's a level of prestige to it, and DS has been quite a big part of the electrification movement for the PSA group, because, you know, as you were saying before with Ferrari, Crawf, the top of the flagship brands and models are what sort of bring out new technologies and then sort of trickle them down. So DS has already started with a lot of electric versions and plug-in hybrids of their cars, and that'll sort of slowly flow down to like Peugeot and Citroen and Vauxhall and whatever, now that they're all using the same platforms. And I imagine that we'll see a lot more electrification from FCA now that they've got joint development, but also I would say funding would be a huge part of that too.
Yeah.
Peugeot and Citroen dominate the French market. And they're quite big across Europe, and I imagine that we'll see those brands sort of come together. And I think you look at the list of brands that we just read out, there's, you know, some 14 of them, and from each side, there's sort of one that lines up with the other. So, you know, you've got Alfa Romeo and DS, you've got Fiat and Citroen, for example. They're sort of like your lower economy level cars. You know, the SUV brands. I don't think that Jeep and Ram perhaps will have as much success in Europe because the cars are so big. But, you know, everything sort of lines up, and I think there's some real good opportunities there. It'd be really interesting to sort of sit back and see what's to come from this new Stellantis group.
Yeah, Mandy, you're right about that new Grand Cherokee. It looks amazing. I was shocked how good it looked. Looked really prestigious, you know.
Yeah, well, it's going to be here before the end of the year. Yeah, so we'll have it in Australian showrooms by the end of the year. So
yeah.
Really nice. Cool looking thing.
Very cool.
Yeah. Speaking of cool looking things, we know Singer make some incredible cars where they improve and restore old 911s. And Croft, I know you love what Singer does as well, but they've now released a new model called the Singer ACS. It's basically a rally 911.
Yeah, the story of this thing is it's the all-terrain competition study. They had the DLS, which was the dynamic and lightweight study, which they did with Williams Engineering and Hans Metzger, who's now passed away, unfortunately, but he was the great air-cooled engine specialist for Porsche since the day one. And this thing, you're right, I thought I was a bit miffed about, you know, the people that were sort of making Safari 911s, but when I actually saw a video of this thing, as we probably all have, but and it's just incredible. And the story behind this is a very wealthy Singer client. I mean, you know, a long-term client, by the way. I mean, this is something I can't even conceive. I'm trying to my dream car right now is a standard classic Singer, they call it, which I drove in a few years back in Alabama, actually. Well, I think I'm one of the only two people that have driven the silver 100th anniversary Singer that Jay Leno drove, and it was sold to a guy that I contacted in Alabama, having gone to school there, and he invited me to come up to have a look at the car, I thought, but he threw me the keys to it, and I drove it for about 20 minutes in regional Alabama up in a place called Florence. And it was the best experience, one of the best experiences I've ever had in my life, given that it was such an exclusive car. And cost him $600,000+ US for the build, which took 2 years, by the way. And he had to supply the 964 donor car. And I suspect that would be another 100 over there. So, you know, it's about $1 million car in the US if you were to bring it here without the import taxes. So you'd probably think looking at 1.4. This thing, the Safari Rally All Terrain Competition Study, that's next level. That goes probably up near the cost of the Williams DLS, which I think was about $1.8 million US. So this thing is right up there. Now the customer hasn't ordered one but two. He's basically ordered a off road version and a dynamic road car version. He's also said to Singer that if someone else wants one of these, go ahead and build them. Go ahead and build them one.
I wouldn't have said that. I would have liked to have had a unique car that no one else has
Well, I think this guy believes that, you know, he would like other people to celebrate and enjoy a car that, you know, look, this car has, it's basically a big nod to the Porsche 959 that won Dakar years and years ago, which was probably the most advanced car in the world at the time with all-wheel drive. And it was just an incredible tour of force of technology, basically. And this car has double suspension dampers on each corner. With single springs up front because of the weight and doubles at the back, of course, with the engineers. And the whole thing's carbon. You know, the interior, I've not seen the interior. I don't know if we have a picture on the site, but apparently that's amazing in this vehicle. And this car is capable, will be capable of running in rally events, essentially. So they want people to drive this car, which is why he said, you know, to Singer that go ahead and build some more if people have got the money and they want this car. And apparently, sort of halfway through it, it didn't look all that amazing. And they kind of went back to the client and said, you know, look, you know, here it is, but, you know, we'd like to do more on this car. And the client said, yeah, go for it. So they just went all out on this car, which is why it looks the way it does. Otherwise, I think it would look just a little bit more of a raised version of the classic, but this is a completely different car. I mean, the headlight unit alone is from a 911, but there's also provision for a pod, a light pod, for obviously, you know, competition rallying. Now, that light pod and those headlights They're actually from the 911 RSR Le Mans racer, and apparently it was such a difficult task to get the software to turn those headlights on. Because nothing, it doesn't matter how many computers you had, apparently in that car, they wouldn't talk. So they had to get some smart people in the Le Mans world of racing to get the computers to talk to these lights to turn them on, because they are that, they are so advanced. So, I mean, there are problems solving that these people had to do to make that, design competition study that, you know, literally had them scratching their heads, and they have to talk to the best. But that's what Singer's always been about. They kind of see themselves as a bunch of mishmash hot rodders, and, you know, where they can't have the expertise, they find the expertise, and they become, you know, a complete force now. There are waiting lists of 3 or 4 years just for the classic Singer. They're about to move from their original garage in LA to a purpose-built massive facility to be able to increase the build number of and increase the time that it takes to build a Singer. So they also said that this is not the only amazing thing, a project that they're going to come up with. They're going to release something really big the end of this year or mid through this year, which will also blow the socks off everyone. So I think this company is really pivoting into a bigger operation. I don't think their cars are going to get any cheaper, unfortunately. I don't even know if anyone has a Singer in Australia or whether they have been imported by anyone. You'd think Lindsay Fox, if he could get one, would get one. Mm-hmm. Seems to get every car that's ever made. Anyone else have anything to say about this car?
Oh, I love what Singer's been doing ever since that first classic 911 that they did. I think I've said this before, and this is probably why I bought my Golf. I like the retro throwbacks, but I like them with a modern twist, which is why I love my car so much, because it harks back to the heritage and the history of, you know, the GTI brand and sort of like the fashion choices back when it was first new. But then adding it with all the current mod cons and convenience features that make it livable in, you know, today's world. And what I love about this is that they're still staying true to the design and look and feel of what a classic 911 is, but like bringing it into the modern age in terms like the power, the technology and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, nothing beats those old classic designs. The reason cars are so, you know, big, square and ugly now is for safety and things like that. But when you get to see these, like, the car design back then was just amazing because you could do whatever you wanted. And what the way that, you know, even today, the overall design of a Porsche 911 hasn't drastically changed from those original concepts. So the fact that you can kind of get back to the car's roots with, you know, all the stuff that would make all the stuff that you would want or need in a modern car, I just am obsessed with that. And the cars that they bring out in the press photos, you know, the cool colors, the cool interior trims and things like that. It's a level of creativity. Like, I wouldn't even consider them hot rodders. I'd say they're coach builders at this point, because they're in these bespoke projects that are, you know, real luxury labors of love and all that kind of stuff. It's so cool what they're doing. And I love that people are getting into it, because they're real passion pieces and something that people can now look forward to or pin up on a wall again. Because, you know, you think about how many people have expensive cars now, like, you know, your standard Lamborghinis, Ferraris, everyone seems to have one. You go into the Melbourne CBD or the Sydney CBD, they'll be everywhere, where stuff like this is still exclusive and you don't see them, you're not going to see them almost ever. So to have something like that, I think is just really cool.
The thing with Singer is most journos don't get to drive them because there is no press cars. They're all sold. You know, I don't think there's a press car in there. So you're at the behest of the owner of that car to allow you to drive, which is why I didn't push it. I probably will repost that 20-minute drive on my own social coming up.
Do it.
Anyway.
All right, we better wrap this baby up. So you can have a look at the Safari 911 up at the site and let us know what you think, because it's a very cool machine that's quite hard to describe. And if you'd like to read up on any more of this week's car news, hit that news link as well. To get a sum up of the 2020 new car sales figures, the VFACTS, we welcome Mike Costello. Hello, Marco.
Hello, Mandy. Happy New Year to you and all the rest of the team that are on this call.
No surprise that 2020 broke all sorts of records for the wrong reasons. So just how bad did the Australian car market fare last year?
Not as bad as a lot of other places. And given the fact that, you know, COVID hasn't quite destroyed Australia like a lot of other places, to the same degree at least, that probably shouldn't be too surprising. So sales totaled 916,968 new vehicles last year. That's the lowest tally since 2003. And it's also the first time that the market failed to top 1 million units since way back in 2009. So that's a year-on-year sales decline relative to 2019 of a tick under 14%. And, you know, as the economy tipped into recession and experienced record quarterly GDP declines on the back of those COVID restrictions, that probably shouldn't be surprising. But there is some room for optimism because market-wide sales grew by 12% during November relative to November 2019 and by 13.5% in December. Now, the first two positive growth months in more than 2.5 years. So some of those market issues predated COVID, but there's definite signs that that upswing is happening. And hopefully if we can get that vaccine sorted within a few months' time and some business normality to return, we can start to see those sales upticks happen again.
And I'm assuming the closure of factories overseas probably impacted on those figures as well?
Yeah, I mean, some of the smarter brands would have forward ordered, but there were plenty of brands that were caught on the hop and weren't able to provide their dealers with as much stock as they would have liked. And, you know, when you consider that, I reckon a decline of 14% for the year is actually not too shabby. And we definitely know of a few brands that are very backed up now. And they've got, obviously, you know, people desperate to get hold of their vehicles and they couldn't during 2020. But it's likely that that demand will carry over into 2021. And those people will want to get into a car at some point this year. So it might actually work out well in the long run. One of the really interesting things I did spot was that SUVs achieved almost 50% total market share for the year. It was about 45% last year. So one in every two cars bought was an SUV, double the market share of conventional passenger cars. And that includes sedans, wagons, hatches, coupes, convertibles, and people movers. And then light commercials, so utes and vans, were 22%. So it gives you a real clear idea now when we talk about SUVs being the dominant segment, the fact that half of every type of car sold last year was an SUV of some size, I think that really kind of sums it up.
Which brand won 2020?
Oh, Toyota, as always, was the market leader. So it was the 18th year in succession. But its dominance was nearly unprecedented. It didn't just win, it absolutely dominated. So it sold more than 200,000 vehicles. No other brand even got to 100,000. And its volumes were down only 0.5% over 2019. And that's in a market down 14%, which means that its market share spiked by 22%, so to 22%. So 22% of all vehicles sold, more than one in five of every vehicle sold wore a Toyota badge in 2020. And that's that brand's best figure since way back in 2008 when it was still making cars here. Moreover, Toyota sold the number one SUV in RAV4, the number one light commercial in Hilux, and the number one passenger car in the Corolla. And more than a quarter of its total, so just over 54,000, were hybrid cars. It projected about 20% of its sales this year to be hybrid. So that electrified vehicle range that it's starting to really grow now was absolutely dominant as well. There really wasn't a segment or a section of the market that wasn't dominated by Toyota.
I find it staggering that Toyota keep doing this, given the likes of Kia particularly offering 7-year warranties against, what, 4 for Toyota?
5.
5? 5 only recently. I just find it staggering that they are able to do this, and I'm sure many would agree that Kia currently, and I haven't picked Kia for any particular allegiance to the brand, but they're offering really nice infotainment systems and screens and arguably, you know, better than what Toyota offer in most of their vehicles. And yet they are still managing to, you know, destroy the competition. What does anyone have an answer to that? Like, why?
Well, I mean, there's a number of reasons for that, Croft. I mean, the first one is Toyota has the widest model lineup of any brand. So, you know, it has got a vehicle in every single segment from the Yaris all the way up to the Coaster bus, Land Cruisers and Prados and all these different, you know, sports cars, hot hatches. It has got far and away the broadest range, right, which means that it alone can cater to every prospective buyer in the market. But
yeah,
I think it really also shows the importance of not just building a brand over the course of a few years like Kia has done, but doing it consistently for decades. Toyota, rightly or wrongly, has a reputation for being utterly unbreakable. Their resale values are always higher than every other brand in the market. Their servicing costs are far cheaper than any other brand in the market. And, you know, I think while we're car nuts, everyone on this podcast is a car nut, and most of the people listening will be too. For a lot of people, a car is just an appliance. They don't want to worry about it. They don't want to think about it. And Toyota is kind of like the default go-to brand for so many people. It's the Coke, it's the Hoover, it's the IKEA. People who aren't going to really sit down and agonizingly research their purchase are just going to go for Toyota, and that is borne out year after year. If we look at other brands that did really well last year, as per usual, Mazda finished in second place with 85,640 sales. That was down 12%, so it also grew its market share. And that's despite jacking up the prices on lots of its cars recently. While Hyundai rounded out the podium with just under 65,000 sales, down 25%. Now, both those brands have previously topped 100,000, so they both took pretty big dives over their previous records. Now, I would note that Hyundai has got a cavalcade of new products coming this year, so you'd expect it to do a heck of a lot better this year than it did last year. The rest of the top 10 were Ford in fourth place. More than half of its sales were Ranger, so without Ranger, it wouldn't be doing so well. Mitsubishi in fifth, though it was down quite significantly this year because fleet sales were quite down and it's so strong in fleets. Kia, as you mentioned before, Crawf, the fast grower, that was sixth place ahead of Volkswagen in seventh, Nissan in eighth. Mercedes-Benz in ninth, that's including its commercial vehicles, and Subaru in 10th. The other really interesting one for me was in a gloomy year where some brands managed to, you know, some manufacturers, you know, managed to sort of fall off the perch a bit. It was actually the Chinese brands that really made a lot of ground. And that's in a climate where there's obviously a huge diplomatic row happening at the moment. Tariffs are being plonked on Australian goods being sent to China. You know, ScoMo and Xi Jinping are kind of having a bit of tit for tat. Relations with China aren't so good right now. And yet MG grew its sales by 83%. To 15,000 units, or just over 15,000 units, and finished 17th overall, and it almost overtook Suzuki. It was very, very close to overtaking Suzuki. And then LDV was up by 44% to just over 9,000 units in 18th place. Now, in Australia, MG and LDV are imported by separate companies, but globally, they're actually the same company. They're part of a massive conglomerate called SAIC Motor. And if you combine those two brands, they sold 24,500 cars last year, putting it in 12th place between BMW and Honda. So when you say the Chinese brands are coming, the Chinese brands ain't coming. They're kind of already here. Yeah. And then on the other side of the coin, you had Haval and Great Wall making significant ground as well. So if you're looking for, I guess, a bright spot or a non-bright spot, depending on your political persuasion, it was the Chinese brands.
Yeah, and the Chinese brands seem to be doing what the Korean brands did a decade or more ago, and that's offer, you know, pretty good cars at very affordable entry prices. And
that's right, mate. And you remember the Hyundai XL of the 90s? Well, the MG3 is that car today. I mean, a new Toyota
maybe
Yaris.
Better than that.
Put it this way, a new Toyota Yaris costs $30,000, an MG3 costs $15,000 with a 7-year warranty and a big touchscreen. Like,
wow.
Not everybody wants a flash, fancy car with all the safety tech. I mean, I'm not going to say that an MG is better than a Toyota. It's not. But for budget buyers, they really do have a lot to offer. And a lot of people are really rolling the dice and taking a chance. And as you say, Croft, they did the same thing with the Korean brands and before that, the Japanese brands.
Yeah.
So this is just the latest in a long line of that. If we look at models, and I mentioned before that Toyota dominated, the Hilux was the number one car overall, and it's a couple of years in a row now where Hilux has been number one. Ford Ranger was number two, although in the more profitable 4x4 sales race, the Ranger was actually number one. Toyota's quite reliant on the, you know, base stripped out 4x2 Trayback Hilux still. And so that means the top two vehicles were utes. Number three overall was RAV4, which made it the number one SUV ahead of the Corolla in fourth. So three of the top four cars, Toyotas. And then rounding out the top 10 was Mazda CX-5, which is a real victim of that RAV4 and is now fallen down to the number two SUV slot. That was in fifth. Sixth was the Hyundai i30. And then after that was the Mitsubishi Triton, Toyota Prado, Kia Cerato, and Hyundai Tucson. Now, that Prado, alongside the 200 series Land Cruiser and the Nissan Patrol, are all selling in massive numbers. And a lot of that is due to the fact that every year Australians spend about $26 billion, according to ABS statistics, on international travel. They can't do that this year. A lot of them are therefore going to go on that big road trip they've been planning forever, and a lot of them are going to go out and buy themselves a big new fancy SUV to tow the caravan. So cars like that will do really, really well.
So, summing up, Moko, how do you see the forecast for 2021?
I see the forecast as being pretty good, and there's a pretty good reason for that. If we look at the buyer breakdown from last year, private sales, and that's sales to just everyday mums and dads and people, were only down 6%, whereas business fleets were down by 16% and government and rentals were down by double digits as well. What that tells me is private demand is strong. We know that business fleet demand is much more prone to economic factors. And I think with some consumer confidence and some, you know, obviously a less restricted environment in 2021, you'll see the business side and the fleet side of the industry pick up once again. You'll see, as I mentioned before, people spending money they would have spent on travel on vehicles instead. And you'll have a lot of car brands really pushing that message to try and push their stock out there. I spoke to a few people at a press conference this week. Among them was the boss of Toyota Australia, Matthew Kelleher, and another one was Tony Weber, who runs the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, that's the FCAI, the peak body for all the car brands. They both reckon the market will be back above a million units this year. All the economic indicators point in that direction. The fact that the last 2 months of 2020 showed sales spikes suggests that will happen. So unless we get a catastrophic COVID outbreak or touch wood, or any other massive issue, I think it's likely that the market will recover this year. The one thing I'm really curious about is what percentage of that growth comes from alternate fueled vehicles. EVs were up about 16% last year, but they were about 0.2% market share. So I'm wondering if we're going to see a spike in those at some point this year. I highly doubt it. But I do think overall we'll see sales definitely grow and stabilize this year. They may not get back to that 1.2 million mark that they were nipping or knocking at the door of a few years ago, but they should be back above seven figures again.
You can have a full read-up of the 2020 VFACTS, the year that was, up now at Car Expert. Mike Costello, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
The fourth generation 2021 Kia Carnival has made it to Australia and it's looking little new. Scott Collier's had the chance to drive it and he is here to talk about it. Hello, Scully.
G'day, guys. It's Paul Marrick here, reviewer of the... No, it's not. It's... hey, guys, how are you? No, so, yeah, just for the sake of clarity, I was impersonating Paul there because Paul has written our Carnival review and done a fantastic video, as he as Igor always do, with the car. Mm-hmm. But he's also out filming today and I've had the chance to spend a few days and a lot of kilometres in the Carnival. I drove it from Melbourne to Moggs Creek and back over the break. So wow. I'm here to sort of sub in and do like a poor impersonation of Paul instead.
It was a very good poor impersonation. So just how new is the new Carnival?
The new Carnival is all new. Often in the car world, when people say something is new, what they mean is it's got new indicator lenses. But in this case, this is a pretty thorough reimagining of what the Carnival is. So not only does it get a new petrol engine, it gets an entirely new body. It's built on a new platform and it's even got a new name. Kia's not calling it a people mover. It's calling it a GUV or Grand Utility Vehicle, which wow. is a bit of marketing spin, but it sort of shows what it has in mind for this car. Rather than making it a pretty boring sort of family van for people who've given up on life, it wants to make the people mover a bit cool again. And I think in quite a few ways it's succeeded. I know from the outside it looks fantastic.
It looks a little bit SUV-like. That was the first thought that came to my mind when I saw photos of it.
Yeah. It does. So in person, it looks a lot bigger than the old one, even though it isn't necessarily all that much bigger. It has grown. It's not like it's gone from X3 size to X7 size, for example. but it's just got a lot more presence about it. So at the front, it's got that really aggressive grille. At the back, it's got a really cool LED light signature and a light bar. I actually showed it to a couple of people who've got previous gen GT line, or sorry, Platinum Carnivals. And the thing they commented on before they sat inside, they've gone, geez, it looks much more aggressive. It's really cool. So Kia's clearly tried to make it stand out. And that focus has carried over to the interior as well, which is a huge step forward from the last one. For one, it's still massive. The boot is absolutely huge, even with the third row in place.
Wow.
I'm just diving through to find the number now.
It's like 650 litres or something with the third row in place, which is more than most sedans and hatchbacks.
Yeah, so with the third row in place, there's 627 litres, and a lot of that is down below the loading lip. So it's got a really deep cavity behind the seats that you can genuinely fit a ton of stuff in. If you put the third row away, or you take the seats out or fold them flat, you can actually get 2,785 litres in there up to the roof, which is just huge.
Massive.
And that's always been one of the big appeals of a people mover. In most of these big family SUVs with seven seats, and even the Hyundai Palisade or the Nissan Pathfinder, they've got a usable-ish space behind the third row, but realistically it's shopping bags or school bags squeezed in there.
Why have they put so much effort into a people mover, which as a segment, you wouldn't call that one of the fledgling segments at the moment, would you?
So Kia owns that segment would be one of the reasons.
Right.
In Australia, Kia has done a really good job of nailing down the microcar segment with the Picanto, and then the Carnival absolutely dominates the people mover segment. It blows away the Honda Odyssey, and it used to blow away the Toyota Tarago, but obviously the Granby is in a slightly different market now. It's comfortably the best seller. So for Kia globally, in the US, there's still a market for these cars. In Korea, there's still a market for these cars. And in Australia, we're actually a reasonably sort of useful market for them because, yeah, it's one of those segments that Kia dominates, and to let that go into someone else's hands would be a really wasted opportunity.
What's the length of it?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Over five?
Give me two seconds. It is 5,115 millimetres long.
Okay, that's a very long car. Does it feel that long when you're driving it?
It does and it doesn't. I know that's a bit of a cop-out, but on the road, it definitely still feels a bit like a people mover in that you sit quite high and you look over a short sort of van-style nose. But it's very easy to maneuver around town because you've got quite a high driving position, and because the nose is so short, it's not like you're piloting a massive bus and you've got to be careful of the corners. It's really quite an easy car to place when you're getting around. So, I mean, there's no getting away from the fact it's big, especially if you're trying to put it in a garage or in a tight parking spot. But to drive in the city, it's really easy, and it's not like parents are going to have to trade in their car license for a heavy vehicle license to drive one.
No, so they haven't obviously gone to the extent of using four-wheel steer or rear-wheel, have they? No.
No, so there's no four-wheel steer, but the wheels are pushed right to the corners and the turning circle is quite good. So, there's not massive overhangs, and it's not like you have to do million point turns. It's fairly well thought out in that you can get around tight enough spaces for a car that is more than 5 meters long.
And did you load it up with, you know, like bikes and stuff and the luxury of being able to throw everything in there and not have it affect your space up front?
Like, so you'll have to look at Paul's video for how our big suitcase and space test sort of stacks up. I drove it a couple of people up. I didn't load it up with eight people. I only had it for a couple of days, unfortunately, but I did sit in all the seats, partly because there were so many to choose from and I was bored over the break, and also partly in the interest of journalistic integrity. And I can say that I can comfortably sit behind myself, and I am 6'7", so like that's already a big win for the second row. And with the second row slid a little bit forward because each of the individual seats slide and recline, I could also get comfy in the back row. So although you wouldn't necessarily want to carry seven adults at the same time, one of the big advantages of something like a Carnival, and this particular Carnival, is that you can carry six or seven teenagers or six or seven children, and they're not sitting on top of each other. You don't need to load them up and throw them in javelin style to get them into the sixth and seventh seat in the back. You can slide the middle row easily. You can also remove the center seat in the middle row, which I know a lot of owners do. The two people that I spoke to down at Moggs did. And it just means that you can walk straight through to the back seats, which obviously if you've got child seats back there or child seats in the middle row, is a huge advantage as well. So unfortunately, I didn't get the chance to drive with it fully loaded up, but having gone for a really good walk around the cabin, all of the seats are really spacious, all of them get USB points, all of them get air conditioning, and there's options for sliding and folding and removing the seat so that if you do, because obviously every family is different, if there is a particular use case that you need to hit, chances are this is going to hit it and probably do a better job than the average SUV.
Is the Carnival missing anything that Kia have overlooked?
It is missing a few things. So the Carnival, although it will get them eventually, launches without a couple of high-end features like the 12.3-inch digital instrument cluster that we get in the Sorento. Instead, it gets analog instruments and quite a small trip computer without that clever blind spot view monitor camera. It also doesn't get rain-sensing wipers. And there's a couple of other little things, like it doesn't get an Australian steering tune at the moment. And the reason for that is that when Melbourne shut down, Kia's engineering centre and its engineers weren't actually able to finish the job of developing those features. So Kia's launching the car because the car is ready and it's here without them, and it'll get them as part of an update late in 2021 for next year's model year. I would argue none of them are deal breakers. The steering tune, although it's not quite as solid as some other Australian tuned Kias on the road, it feels a little bit lighter, the steering, it's still really good to drive. And there are other little bits and pieces like auto wipers and the digital cluster that will turn some people off. But in terms of the job it needs to do and the functionality it's got, it's not exactly missing much.
How did you find the drive?
I was very impressed. The car that we had was a 3.5-litre V6. It's actually a different V6 to what was in the previous car. It's got 216 kilowatts of power and 355 newton metres of torque. There's also a turbo diesel with 148 kilowatts and 440 newton metres. Both are front-wheel drive. There's no all-wheel drive option like you get in the Sorento. And I think the best thing I can say about the way it drives is that it just floats along. I drove it, a lot of time on country highways and pretty average sort of country B roads, and it just soaks everything up really, really effortlessly. And I think if you're a family and you're driving long distances, that's exactly what you want. So it's quiet, the ride is comfortable. I personally prefer a diesel engine in a big family car to a petrol engine, and I do think that the one weaker point in the car that we had was the fact that going uphill, even with just me or with two people on board, it needs to drop a couple of gears to get to the meat of its torque to really get going and rev out, where the turbo diesel is a little more effortless. But I think the best thing I can say about it is that it's just unremarkable. It's quiet and it's comfortable, and it ticks that family box perfectly. There's honestly not too much to report back beyond that, which is pretty high praise, because obviously, if there's a lot to talk about, Kia's either turned it into an incredible sports car or it's doing something very wrong. But the fact it just does its job so well is kind of the highest praise we can give it.
Mm. Well, let us know what you think of the Kia Carnival on the review at carexpert.com.au in the comment on the story. Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
That brings an end to this week's podcast. What cars have we got in the garage next week, Joe?
Well, it's going to be an electric week in Melbourne, doo-dum-choo, because we've got a few EVs coming through the garage. Sorry. Oh, I make myself laugh. So we've got one of the updated Tesla Model 3 long ranges coming in. We've got an Audi e-tron, the wagon one, not the sportback. We've also got a Nissan Leaf, an MG ZS EV, a Toyota Yaris Cross Hybrid, and a regular, degulish, megular Kia Picanto GT line. So a really interesting mix of cars there. And then in Sydney, we've got a Hyundai Tucson Active-X and an MG HS, which we'll be doing a comparison with. And then in Brisbane, we've also got the Audi e-tron Sportback, and we've got a Skoda Kamiq, which we've already reviewed, but some of the guys will be up there will be getting through the car as well.
Anthony Crawford and James Wong, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks Mandy.
Hey, well.